Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And that debt is fraud, and we have to continue to learn, pray, and act. We need to make sure that when we get up off our knees, that we're going to do everything we possibly can, and that obviously we're praying for the strength and the wisdom to do those things that we need to do. But anyway, we're going to dive into some content because this is a fundamental premise, and actually the two objects of government. When they were framing the government prior to the ratification of the Constitution, the concept of why government was being created was, you know, this one of those things that kind of crept up every once in a while, where the axiom, you know, kind of gets reestablished or reaffirmed, that government is created basically to fulfill two objects. First, to protect life. Second, to protect private property. To ensure that a person is secure both in their life and in their property. So that's why we fundamentally create government. Now, in their day, I don't want to say they were simpletons, because these men were well advanced in, you know, in theory and thought and so forth, beyond especially today. As a matter of fact, I was reading an article out of a professor, actually it was a Fox News article, where a professor in the University of Mississippi was making a rant and an argument how illiterate even the education system is regarding our history. Now, having gone through and, you know, education, higher education, pursuing a degree, and having looked at how perverted the education system is, it is easy to understand that what is being taught in the school is not the facts. What a student gets is a textbook. They go spend a lot of money, and typically it's the professor, or if the professor hasn't written, because it's a lazy professor, and they haven't written their own textbook, you know, they all buy into and subscribe the ideologies of another professor who has written a textbook that is not based on fact. That, as a matter of fact, all the textbooks that I've seen are all editorials, where they barely sample actual facts and source documents and so forth. In other words, this is where somebody believes that they have a level of education that's so superior that you cannot impugn what they're saying due to the letters behind their name. In other words, that degree, what have you. And what has happened is we have all been indoctrinated to accept that as the standard, you know, or I should say the metric, because I use that as that basic acceptable gold standard of what is truth. Where does the truth come from? It obviously comes from professors. It doesn't come from the facts or the documents, the source documents. In other words, the concept of teaching primary source documents has been lost. This is one of the reasons why I had to bring this up in the Federalist Papers being the poisonous pill. They were the poisonous pill to the Constitution. That's kind of the gist of the title of the article I'm working on. Now, welcome back, Sean. And Sean, I'm not sure, you know, if and when you went to college, if you did or not, and because it doesn't matter. As a matter of fact, you know, it has been a well-documented premise. It's even been proven that people doing trades actually can make more money than most people that have go out and get a degree. And that has more to do with not necessarily
the trades is a superior way, it's because the trades have this little, they have their own little socialism or communism back behind them, supporting them. It's called the unions, right?
I'd say somewhat.
Yes. Yeah,
in my experience, I've always been an independent contractor in construction, and I also have a degree in education. So I've seen both sides of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen what they're teaching the teachers. And then I've seen the other side of it where, you know, you can make a good living doing things that people need.
Yeah, yeah,
people need houses. People need their cars to run. You know, there's nothing wrong with it.
So
plumbers and AC people are some of the more better off people around.
So here's a good problem within unions and trade. You have the union that basically protects plumbers. I mean, it's kind of a national union of plumbers. And there is a national union of teachers, but I'm not going to point to the teachers. I'm going to actually point to the nurses. See, nurses is another educated skill, you know, career path, right? It's, you have to go and you have to get educated on biology and all these other things. And there is a non-bachelor's degree nurse. There's a certified nurse and so forth. So anyway, the nursing union and the labor that, or I should say the, if you look at the wage a nurse makes in contrast to the wages of a plumber, why is a plumber making as much, if not more, than a nurse when a plumber is not saving your life?
Oh, no. You ever had your toilet back up real bad? That's a pretty serious situation.
Well, so I understand, you know, the consequences of, you know, bad plumbing and plumbing problems. But I have, you know, seen how nurses have literally saved a person's father, their mother, or what have you. And, you know, I don't even want to, you know, get into the mix of the gravity of the two different situations. The point is why is it, and really I've been told, based from a group of, you know, contractors, that bottom line is our society views men as the primary winning, or, you know, earn providing or money making for their home, their household, so that there is a favor towards the dominant male union, where in the dominant female union being the nurses, because even though there's males in nursing, it's still dominant female to this day. And the question is, why is it that there's not, you know, I'll just use the term a come to Jesus, you know, let's really look at what's on the table, what's at stake here, and why is there such a contrast? So technically, and the question is, are we better off because we actually have collectivism and collective bargaining, or are we better off actually allowing, you know, the merit of the person, the merit of the work, and the merit of the profession standing on its own? I have seen, and I live in a state where they have actually passed laws that have literally and deliberately elevated some of these contract construction skills to where, I mean, they're paying outrageous amounts of money. But I also live in a state where they believe in a living wage, that, you know, they have raised the minimum wage over the past 5 years significantly, from like $11 to almost $20. And when you look at the increase on the minimum wage, that percentile, that did not filter into all the other professional wages out there. The nurses didn't get anything close to that kind of an increase over the course of the 5 years. Does that make sense?
Yeah, kind of. I get what you're talking about.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I mean, when you talk about the trades, if you're going to go spend 12 hours a day in an attic putting in vents for an air conditioning system, as opposed to a nurse may, it depends on what area they're in. If they're in an emergency room or something like that, or if they're just in a standard care thing. What I wanted to say about the unions is the teachers have a union too.
Yes, they do.
But I'm going to tell you how it works. The teachers only join the union because they offer them insurance against academic malpractice. Like if
liability, yes.
You have an issue in your classroom mm-hmm. and the parents decide to sue you for whatever reason,
right.
then the union gives you lawyers and protects you. That's why. Because the unions that I experienced were run by the support personnel, like the cafeteria worker managers and the maintenance people managers and school bus driver managers. And they ran the union like a trade union. It didn't have anything to do with teachers.
Yeah, okay. So the background of unions, right?
Not really, but I know that it's got a Marxist tinge to it.
Okay, all right. Okay, so so have you ever read the Communist Manifesto?
No, I have not read it.
Okay.
I've seen excerpts and...
Okay. So fundamentally, when you start going down this path of collectivized labor and equalizing labor, Marx in the Communist Manifesto, his assertion, him and Engels, their assertion is that all labor is equal, that the value of the person committing labor, it's equal, that the janitor is equal to the brain surgeon. And see, right. even you were making the argument, and there are people that where you live, you know, I would think that you thought that you would probably brought this up, and I don't think it's probably unionized at all, where they have guys going out into the Gulf of Mexico, you know, diving way down, doing work on pipes, and they're down there for a month, living in this little, you know, apartment type of setting all by themselves, out welding on pipes and doing that stuff. And then they come mm-hmm. back up and somebody else replaces them. And they make, in 1 month, they make an obscene amount of money that, you know, will see okay. them more than most people make for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I can understand getting people, it's kind of like we talked about judges. You know, when they were expanding the West, they had to give these judges, at first, you know, when we look at a judge making $2,000 going out into some of these territories, when we go through the Enabling Act, you'd be surprised. You know, it's not like there was, you know, a lot of inflation in the cost of housing. I mean, housing, the land was practically free. In many places, right. homesteading. So I could see why a judge living in New York City, you know, would be paid $2,000. But out in South Dakota, when they were creating that territory, you know, they were paying these people because it was an austere place. And it was, you know, you're giving up a lot. I mean, your family may be on the East Coast and you're literally leaving to, you know, to forge a new life because your country has asked you to go do that. So, you know, they pay you. I get that. And I get, you know, crawling in the attic because that may be a job. But, and I also understand the contract trade where you've actually got, you know, I'll just call it the fitting. You know, in other words, when you're doing new construction, you're not crawling in an attic. The attic doesn't even exist yet because all the wiring, the plumbing, the HVAC system, that's all going in before they start sealing everything up. And so it's, you know, it's cookie cutter. It is, you know, kind of, it's not that. Going into somebody's home and doing repairs, you know, now you're tight in constraints under a cabinet, those types of things. But that's, you know, those are cases by cases. And
right.
And the point is that you learn specific things, how to do things, and you learn that skill. And the whole point of this is really taking a new focus on the value of property. Now, we are living in, and we're kind of frozen in this point of time where, as I look at the paradigm, and this is actually something that's came out of the Wall Builders, where there's this quote, and I don't know who was being quoted here, but this is the quote. The moment the idea is admitted into society that property is not as sacred as the laws of God, and that there is not a source of law and public justice to protect it, anarchy and tyranny commence. Now, that's kind of just a flat-out, broad-brush statement. Thomas Jefferson introduced a new concept of property, but what I wanted to do today with content is I wanted to kind of set what I think was the enlightened view, because I've seen others that had very similar, but it was very few people that had the same paradigm of Madison. And so Madison, in I think it's 1792, wrote an essay regarding property. And in this essay, he starts actually expanding this concept of what is your property? Because most people just look at it as just the tangible things you possess, the land, your car, physical things. And Madison actually goes into, you know, a much more deeper look at this, and then starts actually identifying what is our most precious property. And then he talks about a society regarding the importance of property. Now, the reason that I'm doing this, and I, you know, hate to, you know, pollute the water, because sometimes when you talk about why you're doing something, it, you know, tips people off to start looking at things differently. This was the advanced view, or the mature view of property as it was growing in the Age of Enlightenment. There was another view that was coming forth that actually, at this point in time, Jefferson hadn't even been exposed to it. And so we're going to, because we also have this other document that Jefferson kind of identified, and and actually he, if I remember correctly, he sent some information to Madison regarding a concept called usufruct, if I got that right. Let me see if I've stated that right. Usufruct, U-S-U-F-R-U-C-T. Folks, be careful saying that at home. So he's actually talking about a different paradigm where he wanted, and him and Madison, we only have this one letter that I know of that Jefferson sent to Madison that they later on kind of dove into. And this was in 1789, so this was before Madison even wrote that article on property and before they actually started talking about a concept that Madison or Jefferson was exposing to Madison called the land belongs to the living. Now, I'm not, you know, I, like I said, I only have this one little snapshot, but let me just pose to you how we have progressed under the paradigm, the fundamental framers paradigm of property, that property is very sacred. Individual property is sacred. That when people are, you know, living in a state and the, you know, that state is their property. As we go through Madison's paragraph or essay, we're going to start realizing that our rights are our properties and so forth as we read this. But we also have to realize that our government is equally our property because we, right, government is instituted by we the people. And so, and again, government is to protect our lives and our property. We are living in a time that nobody even fathomed, the framers could not fathom, independent monarchs arising. Do you know what I mean by that? What is that? What do I mean by independent monarchs arising?
Like warlords?
Well, no, not like warlords. Kind of similar, but I'm actually looking at monarchs being people that amass so much wealth. You know, captains of industry, these corporations, and they've been able to amass this kind of wealth because the associations and their ties to government in protecting them.
Right.
I mean, when we look at IBM, when we look at
oligarchy.
Pardon me?
Oligarchy.
Well, yeah, but so when we actually look at what's happening to property throughout the United States, it's being stolen. Because there's people that have that much money that can come in and buy it, and they're shutting down the food. And your ability to survive is being threatened because of the individual monarchs and government are working together to basically seize control over all of us under the beautiful blanket of the protection of property. They're committing warfare, basically economic warfare tactics against we the people of the states. And the states are not prepared because they don't have a mechanism of actually going after these folks. But the reason I'm introducing this, and this is not just a quick light conversation and reading, folks, when you start realizing we've got a problem, you have to realize that the problem is happening way upstream, which means that there has been rules and regulations that have been created to allow the crap to get into the river, and now we're looking at the crap floating by. And the average response, because you hear me say this all the time, we got to stop trying to deal with pulling the crap out of the river when we have to actually stop the pollution upriver. We have to stop the mechanism that is basically polluting us and killing us. And so that is all under this umbrella of this, I'll just call it, this symbiotic relationship with corporations and our governments. Your state government is passing laws that are literally allowing your property to be taken from you and literally allowing us to be set up to starve to death. Do they not see this happening? I mean, seriously, Sean, do you think they see this happening?
I think they're facilitating it.
Yeah, but I don't even think, in so many ways, because I don't see people.
I think it's compartmentalized to the point where people are kept funneled into their and siloed into their interests. They kind of know that things are going on, but they don't put it together like you're talking about, where the food supply is in serious danger.
Yes. And this is what scares me, because we have way too many people that are in office that are serving themselves and not paying attention to the macro, to the big view. They're only worried about making sure that they help this bill get passed so that they can get their kickbacks, whatever those things are. But, heavens forbid we find out what they are. And heavens forbid we actually find out who did what and what have you. But actually, the truth is, heaven will expose it all. We're going to find out who was doing what to who and when, because that's all going to unfold. But the truth is, if we're going to survive, we actually have to start changing our paradigm. And so let's look at their paradigm, and let's look at this concept that Madison was being introduced to. And, again, this idea, the earth belongs in usufruct to the living. That's the kind of line in that document that came from Jefferson. But let's go ahead and dive into this essay that Madison wrote and published the 29th of March, 1792. Because as we look at it, we're going into break right now. But as we look at it, all the content that we've currently covered has been in the timeline of 1792, right? The Assumption Act, the Bank Act. I mean, from 1790, 1791, the cod fishery bounties, the things that we've all covered right now since reading the Constitution, actually just before the Constitution and since, has been that little bit of what government started doing. And again, as Washington placed this in his farewell address, even though government may have the best of intentions, it is always the doorway for tyranny to basically be ushered in and levied upon us. So, like I said, we ran out of time, and that's great. I mean, this is a good discussion, and it all kind of starts with what we view our property, our skills, our, you know, our time. All of these things are property, and time is money and those types of things. So as we look at the bigger picture of property, as we look at it from Madison's eyes, we'll be right back to do that. I think it'll open our eyes. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so without any further ado, Sean, why don't you go ahead and start reading, and when we get down to the highlighted parts, I'll kind of start injecting a little bit here. Go ahead. Because I think this all speaks for itself. Go ahead.
This term in its particular application means that dominion, which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world, in exclusion of every other individual. In its larger and juster meaning, it embraces everything to which a man may attach a value and have a right, and which leaves to everyone else the like advantage. In the former sense, a man's land or merchandise or money is called his property. In the latter sense, a man has a property in his opinions and the free communication of them.
Okay.
He has a property of peculiar value in his religious opinions and in the profession and practice dictated by them.
Okay.
He has a very...
Let me go ahead and interrupt at this point. Now he's actually going to provide some introspect on how property is being extended to non-tangible items, like something that you don't hold a deed, something you hold in your hand, as he says, religious opinions. And then he's going to get into our rights and our liberties. Go ahead. Hold on a second. I just paused. Go ahead.
He has a property very dear to him in the safety and liberty of his person.
Keep on going.
He has an equal property in the free use of his faculties and free choice of the objects on which to employ them. In a word, as a man is said to have a right to his property, he may be equally said to have a property in his rights. Where an excess of power prevails, property of no sort is duly respected. No man is safe in his opinions, his person, his faculties, or his possessions.
Okay, so let me stop right there. He basically just said that, in a word, a man is said to have a right in his property. He may be equally said to have a property in his rights. So in other words, you have a right to speak. That's property. If that right is truly yours, then you can say what you want to say. When somebody says you can't say what you want to say, then in essence, they have stolen your property. What is the difference of taking your car away from you, taking your home, or taking your expressions of being able to say this is wrong, calling upon people to stand up, expressing your rights through voice, through writing, what have you? Which is the greater property? And so he's going to dive into this. So go ahead. Where an excessive power, go ahead.
Where there is an excessive liberty, the effect is the same, though from an opposite cause. Government is instituted to protect property of every sort, as well as that which lies in the various rights of individuals, as that which the term particularly expresses. This being the end of government, that alone is a just government which impartially secures to every man whatever is his own. According to this standard of merit, the praise of affording a just securing to property should be sparingly bestowed on a government which, however scrupulously guarding the possessions of individuals, does not protect them in the enjoyment and communication of their opinions, in which they have an equal, in the estimation of some, a more valuable property. Amen.
There you go.
More sparingly.
Keep going.
Yeah, more sparingly should this praise be allowed to a government where a man's religious rights are violated by penalties or fettered by tests or taxed by a hierarchy. Conscience is the most sacred of all property. Other property, depending in part on positive law, the exercise of that being a natural and unalienable right, to guard a man's house as his castle, to pay public and enforce private debts with the most exact faith, can give no title to invade a man's conscience, which is more sacred than his castle, or to withhold from it that debt of protection for which the public faith is pledged by the very nature and original conditions of the social pact. That is not just a just government, nor is property secure under it, where the property which a man has in his personal safety and personal liberty is violated by arbitrary seizures of one class of citizens for the service of the rest. A magistrate issuing his warrants to a press gang would be in his proper functions in Turkey or Hindustan under appellations proverbial of the most complete despotism. That is not a just government, nor is property secure under it, where arbitrary restrictions, exemptions, and monopolies deny to part of its citizens that free use of their faculties and free choice of their occupations, which not only constitute their property in the general sense of the word, but are the means of acquiring property, strictly so-called.
Okay, so here he's basically laying out that even the ability to acquire property is a fundamental right. The ability to survive, these things are fundamental rights. And so he's going to get into now creating where government actually starts going down the path of starting to say, you know, if you're going to die and the cloth in your casket is going to be a certain linen, they require that you buy this very particular linen that comes from a very particular, you know, manufacturer, what have you. So in other words, he actually starts showing the way forward in using regulations over property of waging tyranny that's actually violating the essence of all these other rights. Go ahead, keep going.
What must be the spirit of legislation where a manufacturer of linen cloth is forbidden to bury his own child in a linen shroud in order to favor his neighbor who manufactures woolen cloth, where the manufacturer and wearer of woolen cloth are again forbidden the economical use of buttons of that material in favor of the manufacturer of buttons of other materials? A just security to property is not afforded by that government under which unequal taxes oppress one species of property and reward another species, where arbitrary taxes invade the domestic sanctuaries of the rich and excessive taxes grind the faces of the poor, where the keenness and competitions of want are deemed an insufficient spur to labor, and taxes are again applied by an unfeeling policy as another spur in violation of that sacred property, which heaven, in decreeing man to earn his bread by the sweat of his brow, kindly reserved to him in the small repose that could be spared from the supply of his necessities. If there be a government, then, which prides itself in maintaining the inviolability of property, which provides that none shall be taken directly, even for public use, without indemnification to the owner, and yet directly violates the property which individuals have in their opinions, their religion, their persons, and their faculties, nay more, which indirectly violates their property in their actual possessions, in the labor that acquires a daily subsistence, and in the hallowed remnant of time which ought to relieve their fatigues and soothe their cares. The inference will have been anticipated that such a government is not a pattern for the United States. If the United States mean to obtain or deserve the full praise due to wise and just governments, they will equally respect the rights of property and the property in rights. They will rival the government that most sacredly guards the former, and by repelling its example and violating the latter, will make themselves a pattern to that and all governments.
Okay, so for the benefit of the listener, there's a word you said that, you know, most people struggle over, inviolability. That's holiness. In other words, if there be a government than which prides itself in maintaining the holiness, the sacredness of property, then, you know, they need to do these very specific things. The bottom line is, as we started talking, we talked about labor. Your labor is your property. And collectivizing labor, and this is the whole scheme of socialism and communism, is that everybody's labor is treated equal, that everybody is deserving of a specific wage. That's what the unions do. And I was basically comparing and contrasting some labor is actually worth more than others. But in cutting to the chase, I pointed out that the premise of communism is that all labor is equal, that the labor of the janitor is just as valid and equal to the brain surgeon, anybody and everybody in all different forms of labor. It's all equal. And that can't stand. And as a matter of fact, even Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, which was written in 1776, talks about the importance of recognizing one laborer over another for superior labor quality and so forth and so on. That when we water down what everybody does, we destroy the fundamental tenets of industry in production. And basically, what Madison's talking about is what we see in the implementation of all of these different regulations. Does America truly value and consider property holy? No, because they actually have allowed unions to run amok, and especially all government positions are union positions practically. On top of that, though, let's look at it this way. If you live in a state where they have created a law that says your current property that you have is inadequate, that you need, what you have, I give you a good example, tires on a car. If your tires on a car are under a certain threat, now they don't come and, take those tires off. But what they've done is they've created a law that says any workshop, any mechanic that pulls the tires off and they're working on your brakes, doesn't matter why those tires came off. When the workshop basically says, and you know what, the workshop that sells tires will actually do this. Workshop that doesn't may not, but by law they're supposed to. They're supposed to tell you, I cannot put these tires back on your car, because the law does not allow me to. Even though it's your property, you have to replace this property because the government has considered it inadequate to be on their roads, forcing you to become a participant in buying a product long before you were probably even willing to do that. In the old days, we used to actually have to run on, when I talk about old days, I'm talking about literally my grandparents. they actually had to drive on bald tires because the government wouldn't even allow the production of new tires. They actually started manufacturing inner tubes so that you could actually get more life out of your existing tires. And the used tire market became this whole big thing. And I remember when I was very young, and Sean, you probably do this too, where you could actually go and buy used tires from a gas station or what have you.
You still can.
Okay, so in some places, they don't let you do that anymore. In some states, they don't allow that to happen. They force all tires to be recycled, which basically means that whatever productivity might be left in that property, the government says, we don't care. You have to spend more money. And that's all in the, basically the whole point of that is to take you to into the market space so that the manufacturer of these products can make more money. This is the same thing as when he talks about this linen, right? The linen cloth, whether it be wool or what have you. When government gets into that space, then, you know, and we start seeing this, then the real question is government really trying to maintain the inviolability or the sacredness of our property rights? What do you think?
I think it's pretty corrupt. I know you're talking about the tires. There's a scenario situation in our state where we have to pay $2 per tire disposal fee. I started getting into that subject for some business opportunities, and it turns out that they're only paying to have the tires transported to somewhere else.
Right.
And they're not actually recycling them.
Okay.
So, and we just had a fire like a year ago where one of these storage yards caught on fire with the tires, and you know how tires burn. It was just horrible. And then they have people that dump them. They'll transport them. The company will make the money to transport them, but they can't store them safely. So they dump them out in the marsh. And then they catch on fire and burn for a month or two and just totally tear up the environment, cause all kinds of hazards. Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous.
Right. So all of this is where government, the reason why government is doing this is because these lobbyists for tire manufacturing and the tire reselling, like Discount Tire, you know, there are these big chains, Costco, who, you know, if you look at where and who sells the most tires out there, Walmart, you'll start realizing that all of them kind of pool their money into going into your state legislature to get your state legislature to pass a law to basically take away your right to be able to use your property to a point where you no longer can use it, where you finally got a flat and you, okay, I'll replace the tire now. Now, here's the thing. The law that they create is actually unconstitutional because when you bought that tire, now this concept of a ex post facto law is something that basically says that we can't make something that was legal when you bought it illegal later on so that we can come after you and fine you or take that away from you, what have you. But the concept of creating a class that says that class can't exist, in other words, this state of tire can't exist, and we're going to punish you, we're going to force you to have to go out and buy something, that kind of falls under a bill of attainder and punishment. We talked about that a long time ago when we were going through the Constitution. The fact is that you should have a right to be able to have those tires placed back onto your car. All you would need to do to indemnify that shop that says, hey, the law says I got to do this, then you should be able to opt out by signing a liability waiver to say, I take full liability in operating my car. You already do that, and that's why you have your car insured. This is just a racket of basically getting you to get rid of still perfectly good property and forcing you to spend money on, you know, and putting you into the market space so that certain manufacturers and retailers make money off of you. This is repugnant. It has no place in America. But this is even still the small little, I'll call it, the noise. Because, I mean, this is just rampant throughout the states, where the states are doing this. And to me, I think the most important thing, because this is where we, I want to get back to this bigger idea, where we're missing how government has created associations and or powers. Let's start with the federal government. There's a, you know, the Department of Interior was unconstitutionally created. And the Department of Interior started seizing and basically becoming the holder of masses of state land. And as they've held this land, they hold on to it and they get to decide what they want to do with it. And this is all unconstitutional. They've been going after farming land and very rural areas, basically trying to buy up, you know, small independent ranches and farms and so forth to basically decimate the interior, or I should say the ultra and the rural areas of many, if not all of the states. I mean, there are some states that I don't even know if they have a rural area. You know what I mean? Like Rhode Island. I don't think Rhode Island has a rural area. Do you think that? What do you think? Have you ever been there?
I've never been there. I would imagine that it is a rural area, not has a rural area.
So actually, so when I say rural, what I mean by that is not, you know, antique, old. What I mean...
No, I know what you mean. Country.
Well, yeah. Sparsely populated. I believe right. Rhode Island is nothing but basically concrete. It's been developed. I mean... If I went and looked at a map of Rhode Island and I zoomed in with a, you know, satellite image, I would probably not see hardly any land at all that probably hasn't had some level of development, whether it's a park or something. I mean, I don't think there's anything rural about Rhode Island. That's what I mean. You know, the only places where you really find rural land where, you know, animals live wild is towards the west, where there's large, you know, huge parcels of no development, no what I'll call, you know, no sign of humans, you know, whether that be roads, buildings, power lines, utilities, those types of things, where it's pitch black at night. There's no streetlights, no streets. Anyway, so the point is that this is a part of the Agenda 21. In other words... Prior to the Agenda 21, they had already been leaning and trying to make sure that this paradigm of public land is, you know, for the better of everybody. And so they've been basically, you know, creating public land by subsidizing farms. If you think about it, in the 70s and the 60s, when they actually started subsidizing farmers, and even before that, they were literally paying farms not to farm. That's the whole point of a subsidy, right?
Yeah, that's crazy.
So when they were paying farmers not to farm, the farmers benefited, right? I mean, they basically made pretty close to what they would have made had they farmed. And that money being a handout from the federal government is non-taxable. At least I think at the time it wasn't. And what ended up shorting the market was not just the market itself, but because that what that did was it maintained a higher price so that those who were farming were getting a better price for what was taken out of the market. But on top of that, the state made no money on your productive, you know, for that year of productivity that you would have had. It was a direct attack on your state revenue, and the states didn't do anything about it. Now, maybe they were getting a subsidy and a handout as well. Who knows? The point is the federal government, first off, the fact that they even have land outside of those parcels that are enumerated in the Constitution is just, it boggles my mind. that we allow this to happen. But more importantly, they've created this context of taking and taking and taking land and making sure it is not being used for the purposes of actually producing good quality food and putting food into our system. So when we look at the fact that it's being sold, now land is being sold to foreigners and or being sold to billionaires, globalists that are coming in and buying land, whether they live in your state or not. And none of the states see what is happening. Excuse me. None of the states are even recognizing this true threat that's on the horizon. If things continue the way they are, and we actually have in the areas of the world where food is being produced that we're dependent on, what the heck are we going to do?
Starve.
How are you going to get your hamburgers, America? How are you going to get your French fries if we're dependent on these things coming to us from foreign markets? You can't just put water on the ground and have a cow.
Right.
Okay. So it takes
time. Same thing with the pharmaceuticals. I think that's a big deal, too.
It is. Absolutely, it is. So I think the point is that the states really need to start looking at real property rights, because the property doesn't just – they're too focused on the tangible property and allow – you know, a person has a right to buy property. Every person has the same right to buy property. But what if that person is deliberately buying up property to harm everybody else in the community, in the state? Does that right persist over the rights of others? And right now it does, because we're actually protecting and enabling this crap to happen. This goes back to, I mentioned this to you before, in 2020, I laid out this 40-page, you know, outline of issues for what I would call a Bill of Rights for the 21st century, because we needed to start looking at property rights. We really needed to reevaluate property rights and who should be holding them. I don't believe it should be held by the state at all. I believe it really needs to come back to the county and maybe subdivided into, you know, the districts of the county to allow the communities to have better control over that land.
Yeah, or it's like BlackRock buying up all the houses renting them. They don't sell houses anymore. They buy up all these houses in these neighborhoods, and then they refuse to put them on the market for sale. They only specifically rent them.
Yeah, and so what they have done is they've actually created commodities called housing to say, we control the housing. You can't buy it, but we will lease it to you or rent it to you, what have you. Right. We're running out of time. We're going to carry this over into the next episode. And so we'll dive into this concept of land belonging to the living and how we really – this begins the conversation at the table of trying to figure out how can we actually start invoking laws that not just protect the individual property rights, but actually protect all of our other rights to survive and so forth, because we're being set up to be killed. We're walking down the trail to our own slaughter. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.